Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the money we have to put away for our children's education, and then the debts to make that work out. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. Later in the program, I'll have more to tell you about the websites and other services that we maintain for you. But I want to draw your attention in one particular case to something that I would urge you to do. We are producing a regular newsletter that keeps you abreast of all the different things we're doing. The radio programs, the monthly economic updates here in New York City, my speaking trips around the country, clips from my news interviews on radio and television, and so on. It is an absolutely free newsletter, and the simplest way is for you simply to sign up for it. And here's how to do that. Go to either of the two websites that we maintain, rdwolf.com or democracyatwork.info. Either of those websites will show you a simple way to sign up for a newsletter, which will then come to you automatically and keep you aware of all the different things we're doing, including this radio program, but also beyond it. All right, let's jump right in to the economic updates for this last week. Well, on Tuesday of this last week, there was an election in the province of Alberta, in Canada. And the May 5th election in Alberta was an explosion of new political directions that will ramify not only in the province of Alberta, but also across Canada, down into the United States and beyond. For the last 44 years, the province of Alberta, Canada, has been run by the Progressive Conservative Party. That's the party in power in Canada nationally. It is a very conservative party, very closely associated with the oil and other natural resource interests that are very important to the Alberta economy. The people there have been told that a conservative approach is the right way to go, particularly in matters economic. So they've had a kind of austerity program. They've had all the kinds of shifting of wealth and power from the middle and lower classes on the one hand to the super rich on the other. You know what I'm talking about because it's a global phenomena. But not anymore, not in Alberta, Canada. The election on the 5th of May produced a stunning victory for the most left-wing party that Alberta has, the New Democratic Party. And its leader, the very popular Rachel Notley, will now be the leading official of that state since her party captured an outstanding majority. The seats of the Progressive Conservatives went from 70 in the state legislature to 10. That's about as stunning and utter a defeat as one could want. What is the platform of the New Democratic Party that will take over the government of Alberta? I will read to you from the news stories that pretty well summarize it. NDP platform includes $15 minimum wage, increased taxes for the wealthy and corporations, a royalty review for Alberta's massive oil and gas industry, boosting funding for schools and hospitals, protecting social programs, and taking a leadership role in climate change activities. Wow. It is the direct opposite of the kinds of conservative government in terms of economic policy, which is why it's on this program, Economic Update. Last interesting point. Alberta is the youngest province in Canada. The median age of people in Alberta is 36. The enthusiasm generated by the younger generation translated into the highest voter turnout in 22 years at 57%. More people came out than for many, many years, and they were young people. and they wanted their voice to be heard, and it was the rejection of the conservatives overwhelmingly and the embrace of the kinds of political position many of the media keep telling us are non-starters in politics. Maybe we have to rethink that, don't you think? Next update. The schools in Kansas are closing early, before they were scheduled to. In some cases, 2 to 3 weeks earlier. That's eating into the substance of what young people in Kansas are going to be able to learn in going to school. 8 different districts are closing their schools early. Why? Because the state of Kansas has no money to pay for basic public education. And why is that? Because the Republican-controlled legislature there and the Republican governor, Sam Brownback, took great pride last year in cutting the taxes, particularly of the richest folks in Kansas and of businesses in Kansas. And in order to make that bitter pill go down a little easier, he cut taxes on middle and lower income people, not very much, but enough to get them hopefully focused on that so they wouldn't notice the tremendous benefit given to corporations and the rich. And all of that was justified with what we used to call voodoo economics, the promise that by lowering taxes on rich people, they would do all kinds of things called job creation. It didn't happen. And by cutting taxes on business, they would invest and create jobs. It didn't happen. And so without the jobs being created, the revenues of the state of Kansas are not flowing in, and so they're closing schools in order to undercut the quality of their labor force's skill and education, thinking, what, that's going to be an economic development program? Not too likely. And what did the governor propose to do about all this? Boost taxes on cigarettes and alcohol. That's right, whack the people who can afford it least, the average citizen who has to pay a much higher percent of his or her income for cigarettes or alcohol than a rich person does. Because the tax on, for example, a can of beer is the same if your name is Rockefeller as it is if your name is Jones or Smith. It's an unfair tax, and that's what the governor of Kansas proposes in order to slow down his attack on public education. Wow. Not much more I need to say on that, is there? Too bad that Kansas is not alone. Illinois is doing similar things. Indiana is considering similar things, and so on. The mantra that by helping businesses and rich people by cutting their taxes, that this is some magic formula for economic growth, expansion, and well-being, was a laughable joke in the first place, and it's turning into a tragedy for the school children in these states as it is allowed to continue. Maybe what Kansas needs is what Alberta already did. Next item, the Gallup poll. Released, Gallup poll, by the way, one of the oldest and most respected polling institutions in the United States, released the results of its recent questionnaire dated May 4th, 2015. In this questionnaire, it asks a representative sample of Americans whether they are satisfied or dissatisfied with the distribution of wealth and income, and then asks them a question about a policy designed to change things if they're dissatisfied. And the Gallup poll has been doing this at least as far back as 1984. So we have 30 years to look at. And here's what the poll showed that I thought to share with you all, because I think there's a lesson for us here. First, 63%, that's nearly two-thirds, of Americans asked are dissatisfied with the distribution of wealth and income in America because they think too much of the wealth and income is in the hands of too few of the richest part of the society. Let me say that again. For 30 years, by the way, the numbers haven't changed much. For 30 years, with a slight variation, something on the order of 3/5 to 2/3 of Americans, clear majorities, all the time, think that the distribution of wealth and income is unjust, unfair, and tilts way too much toward the rich. But here comes the even more interesting. In the latest poll, a second question was asked. Do you agree or disagree that the really rich should be hit with a heavy tax to correct for the unjust distribution of wealth and income? And on May 4th, Gallup reported 52% of Americans, a slim majority, but a majority, believe in heavy taxation of the rich. And notice that, too, has been fairly constant over 30 years. Wow. A majority of Americans for 30 years are dissatisfied with the unfair distribution of wealth and income, and a clear majority want the rich to be heavily taxed to fix this problem. So what's the lesson here? Well, for 30 years, that's been the majority view, and for 30 years, not only has that not been done, the opposite has been done. The distribution of wealth and income in America has become more unequal over the last 30 years, not less. The tax burden on the super rich has been reduced, over the last 30 years compared to what it was in the 1970s and 80s. So not only does the political system not respond to what clear majorities want, it flaunts in their faces the opposite. The lesson? Simple. Those who were already very rich and who wished to become richer knew what they had to do. They had to buy the political system to make sure it did not serve what the majority said they wanted, and instead did the opposite. That's why campaigns cost what they do. That's why the candidates who run have to do what the big donors want them to do. And that's why what we, the people, want and what the political system delivers are opposites of one another. Okay, let me now quickly complete the update so we can move on to my responding to your questions. Recently, some of the private car services that we've been talking about, Uber, Lyft, and others, have been finding themselves rejected from various countries, rejected from various cities and states, and so on. And in their defense, they have made an interesting comment I want to spend a moment on. They argue that they are a market-driven enterprise. That is, unlike the taxis in the cities where they compete, the taxis are governed by a state commission that sets the rates and that sets the rules, etc., whereas they are market-driven, and that, they say, is what makes them superior. This is a thin effort to ride on the ideological notion that markets are efficient. Well, I'm not going to deal with that. I do that many a time anyway. What I want to do is underscore one way that the market works for Uber and Lyft, and then ask all of you to think about it. Here's how it works. If there is a sudden surge of demand for rides in a city, what Uber does is jack up the price. They don't have enough cars and people driving to meet the demand, or at least if they don't, they solve the problem by raising the price. And that indeed is how markets work. If there's not enough to go around, then the people who want more than there is start bidding against one another to get it. And as the price goes up, here we go, those who can't afford the rising price have to do without. Now, let's see. It's pouring outside, or it's snowing outside, or it's extremely cold outside, or the conditions are icy and you don't want to walk because you're elderly, because you're infirm, because you're getting over a sickness. But because of the cold and the ice and the storm, there are more people who need a ride. And so who gets the ride when there aren't enough to go around? The rich people do, those who can pay the rising price. That's how markets work. They exclude the people who don't have enough money. And by contrast, here's how the taxi system works. Everybody pays the same. You can't and you won't exclude middle and lower income people by raising the price because you can't do that. And that means everybody, more or less, has an equal shot at getting the taxi ride. You answer the question whether you want the market to work or whether you have human values that the market contradicts. Last thing, I really can't avoid talking about this. I have mentioned Warren Buffett more than a few times. Usually in a positive way, because at least he's had the courage to say openly that our tax structure is fundamentally unfair, that because of his lawyers and accountants, he gets to pay a lower tax rate than his secretary is required to pay, and he became famous for that. But of course, Warren Buffett is a businessman, and a big businessman. He is one of the richest people on the planet, has made a fortune out of his company, Berkshire Hathaway. The vice chairman, just under Warren Buffett, is Charles Munger. And Munger and Buffett and a few others are the ones that took over the Heinz Corporation, you know, the ketchup maker, back in 2013, and promptly fired 7,000 workers from the Heinz company. And then just a few weeks ago, they merged Heinz into the Kraft Food Company, a $25 billion company that will be one of the largest food companies on earth. And they anticipate firing, laying off thousands more. And Mr. Munger, at the recent public meeting of the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway, was asked whether he doesn't feel a pang, Mr. Buffett as well, for doing things that deprive tens of thousands of American families of their jobs and incomes, crippling the communities where they live because they won't be able to pay taxes anymore, etc., etc. Oh, no, said Mr. Buffett, quote, efficiency is required over time in capitalism. Wow. But even more interesting was the comment of Charles Munger. I should mention he's 91 years old. But at their meeting of the Berkshire Hathaway Corporation in their home base of Omaha, Nebraska, here's what Mr. Munger said. The alternative to cutting staff is, quote, what happened in Russia, end quote. The whole damn economy didn't work, referring to Russia. Okay, I don't mind that Mr. Munger says silly and historically wrong things. I don't mind because I'm not going to be critical of a 91-year-old person for anything that they say. However, this is a comment that is made so often it demands a response. I am a critic of the what happened in the Soviet Union, as are many others. But a criticism doesn't mean you dismiss wholesale everything that a society does. A criticism, to be valid, has to be carefully framed to focus on what is really a failure and a failing, and not sweep away the baby with the bathwater. That would be a mistake. So let's look at what the Soviet Union accomplished, this economy that people like to say didn't work. In 1917, when the modern Soviet economy was born in a revolution, Russia was the most backward country in Europe. The vast majority of its people lived in the countryside, farmed the land, were illiterate. 1917. Not only did the revolution happen in a country with that situation, but that country had just lost World War I, experienced an invasion of four countries. The United States, Britain, France, and Japan invaded the Revolutionary Society in order to crush that revolution. They failed, but they did a lot of damage. And there was a revolution, and after the revolution, a civil war. My God, a terribly poor, backward economy, crippled by all those things I just mentioned. So what did they accomplish? Between 1917 and 1970, a period of roughly 50 years, the Soviet Union went from a war-ravaged, revolutionarily ravaged, poor backward country into the number two superpower after the United States. It developed its industry at a pace no capitalist country has ever reproduced. And as if that weren't enough illustration, the copy of the Russian system, the People's Republic of China, has now become the number two after the United States, having experienced spectacular growth from a starting point even more poverty-stricken than that of the Soviet Union. An economy that didn't work? No, Mr. Munger, you've got it wrong. You need a little history work. This is not an excuse for the bad things that happened neither in Russia nor in China. Those have to be exposed and criticized. But an economy that didn't work? Wow, that's just ignorance. Nothing more, nothing less. Okay, let's turn quickly to the questions that you asked. I want to express my gratitude to Phil McCarthy, who sent in a wonderful article from the Washington Post by an author named Pincus, who points out in his article, by the way, the article was April 27th, and the writer was Walter Pincus, that a number of people have been noticing recently the enormous benefits to private enterprise in the United States from government-funded and government-organized research. The computer, the internet, many of the key components to the Apple iPhone these days, these were all basic research breakthroughs achieved in and by government agencies and or universities using government money to pay for the scientists and the materials and the laboratories and so on. And why is this being brought out? Because the public pays for the research that is then provided to a private corporation, which makes private profits off of it. I want to stress two things about this as fundamental. First, if the government uses our money, taxpayer money, to subsidize private enterprises by producing breakthrough research that they make a fortune off of, let's call it what it is. It's welfare for corporations. Either call it welfare for corporations or call the food stamp program a subsidy for low-income people to be matched by the subsidy for huge profitable corporations that publicly funded research represents. And by the way, more has been spent, especially by the Defense Department, on all of this kind of research than has been spent on many public welfare programs. The second thing I want to say is, you know, a fair way to deal with this would be give the government a share of those profits. Make the government a shareholder. They do that in other countries. We could do it in ours. Well, folks, we've come to the end of the first half of our program. We're going to shift in a few moments to the second half, where I will introduce a guest and we will talk about the relationship between capitalism and children and their condition in the world today. But before we change, I do want to remind you to make use, if you can, of the websites rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, because they provide all kinds of opportunities that you will benefit from, and they're available 24/7 and they are completely free.
Pink toes, press against the carpet, show your face and finish what you started. The record spins down the alley late night. Be my friend, surround me like a satellite. Tiger on the prowl, east of Eden, coming for you now. Keep me from the cages under the control, running in the dark to find me still reading. Keep me from the cages under the control, running in the dark to find me still reading. 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 Call me wild, drinking up the sun.
Welcome, friends, to the second half of Economic Update, this edition at the beginning of the month of May 2015. I want to begin by introducing my guest for this second half, someone I have brought back to the program in large part because so many of you sent me emails and in other ways communicated to me that you would like more from this guest and more of the kinds of conversations we've had. And so I'm responding to that request that you've made. And I appreciate your taking the time and trouble to let us know what you want us to do. My guest is Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a mental health counselor and a hypnotherapist with a regular private practice in New York City. She writes considerably in a variety of places about the intersection of personal life and the United States economy. Dr. Fraud,
thank you,
Harriet, if
me.
I may call
yes.
you, thank you very much for joining us again.
Glad to.
Today's topic is U.S. capitalism and children. Everyone knows about the rising economic pressures on average families in the United States, particularly over the last 6 or 7 years since the crisis of 2008 hit. We've heard things like the disappearing middle class, the vanishing American dream, and all of these things. And my assumption is, and what I want to begin with, is tell us something about the effects on families and children. After all, children are the most innocent of all of our people. What's happening to them? Give us a thumbnail, if you can, about the results of the economic system, and then we'll go through and try to analyze why that's happening.
Well, one way to get across to you about a thumbnail, what's happening to American children, is just to give you some indicators. One is that in our capital, Washington, D.C., a low-income child is 10 times more likely to die in childbirth as a wealthier child, 10 times. So we're talking about the life or death of children. Partly that's because prenatal care is not available to people who are low income as it is to wealthy people. Partly it's because not only the medical care being available, but the quality of it. Partly it's because they want to cut the women's and and infants' nutrition. Partly it's because of the nutritional programs that should be out there in our society don't exist. Fruit and vegetables are more expensive, and fresh things are more expensive than canned. And so the diet of low-income people is much worse, and their health deteriorates. And so, of course, so does their children's. Of all the developed nations in the world, according to UNICEF's study, in stature on child well-being, the United States is dead last.
This is among the so-called advanced industrial countries.
Yeah, which include places like Poland, which is not known as the wealthy Mecca, you know. But it includes countries like Czechoslovakia. So it, but it more developed countries, not the wealthiest in the world, but more developed. Among the world nations, the United States is also the world leader in child poverty. And child poverty means less good schools, less safe home, greater precarity of parents, greater tensions on a family which come out against children, less safe neighborhoods, less safe playgrounds, and on and on and on, eroding the quality of life for children. Among the developed nations, this poverty also means that one in four children in the United States is in a family that gets food stamps and experiences what they euphemistically call food scarcity, which is food hunger, hunger for food. And unfortunately, some in the U.S. Congress, led by someone called Jack Kingston, a Georgia Republican, say there shouldn't be any such thing as a free lunch. Therefore, low-income children who get subsidies for school lunch should have to sweep the cafeteria and do work. Of course, that says nothing about the children of the rich who get endless luxuries and do not have to work for them, but just get them because their parents are rich. So how did we get to this point where we would say such a thing? How did we get to the point where they're even talking about cutting the food stamps, which are a basic means of sustenance for 16 million children in the United States?
Let me add a couple, because you sure stimulate my own reflection about it, as I'm sure you're doing for people listening to this program. Detroit has resumed cutting off water for tens of thousands of people.
That's right.
The United Nations has declared that adequate supplies of water, not just for children, but for adults, is a human right.
Mm-hmm.
Most European countries believe that medical care is a human right.
That's right.
In the United States, our top leaders prefer to say it's a privilege, because that way you can justify, I suppose, why the privilege of medical care is not given to the mass of people, but only to those who can afford the privilege. It's a little like in the last half hour, I tried to show that what Uber market reliance means is that in an ice storm, the richest people will get home safe and the others won't.
They won't.
Which
right.
is a major way of organizing your society. And what strikes me is we live in a society where the same people celebrating the market, thinking of medical care, even water, as a privilege you have to pay for and won't get if you can't afford it, are the same ones who an hour later in front of the TV camera will talk about family values, their commitment to the family, which presumably includes the children who are being treated in the way you describe. It's just, it's really too much sometimes when you listen to this.
Yeah, it is a tremendous contradiction between stating that you believe in family values and taking away every support there is for a family, like after-school programs, like quality school lunches, like subsidy for low-income families to buy school supplies, like summer programs for children who play in the street because there's nowhere else to play while their parents work, like after school programs. A country like France has free medical care, which is high quality, and free education starting at 3 years old, which is 100%, where children get three meals a day and medical care, and where everything isn't up to their parents. And if a parent abuses a child in France, they have a social worker assigned for 5 years to that family to make sure that the family can survive and that those children are treated well. It isn't like it is here, where a welfare person,
caseloads are
about 60 families each, where people can't go, where they can't make all their cases and care, and where children are killed every week by parents or relatives known to the welfare system. 85% of the murders of children happen in the family, and yet there are no supports for the family. In France, they have child care allowances for people who have over two children. They also have subsidies for school supplies, and they also have truly quality after-school programs for children so they don't come home to an empty house.
Yeah, the irony of the United States in
family
economic...
Family values, those are.
Yeah, not just that, but the irony is if you don't want the government to support people, then give them the jobs and give them the incomes so that they can take care of this themselves. The beauty of the ideology that has grabbed the right wing in American society and others is the ability to insist that the workers get paid as little as the employer wants, and then that there nothing is done for the people who then have to live an impossible life because you can't take care of your children and your own needs with that amount of income. You really can't have it both ways, or to put it otherwise, if you insist, then don't talk about family values, don't talk about democracy and equality, because you're condemning a huge part of your population to being desperate all the time, therefore unlikely to be involved in a political effort since they're running around scrounging to make a decent life for themselves under circumstances that put every obstacle in their way.
And also being very depressed at their inability to do so. You know, a perfect example of this family values contradiction is because they have lowered salaries, there's nobody at home with the children. Two people have to work and make less of a quality of life than one used to in the 1960s and 70s. And so you take, I'm not saying women belong staying at home. I do believe in quality childcare instead of women being homebound. But if you force women out of the home into the labor force, then you don't have them home taking care of children because men can't afford to have somebody at home taking care of their home and their children. So that the family values is a sick joke. And, you know, this, the discrimination against the mass of children, we're not talking about a small group. The majority of children in America's public schools are low-income children. That's the majority. For the first time in our whole history, the majority of children in public schools are low-income children. Now, what is this?
Can you help us understand how did that come to be? Where are the other children?
The other children are either in private schools or there's many fewer of them. People who have children now are recent immigrants who have the most children because they don't know how they will not get any help and how expensive it is here. And the very wealthy who, as we know, are few in number.
Right.
Those people at the top of our society, to be generous, the top 20% can afford to have children. But you have fewer and fewer children. People who often plan their lives don't have children because they're too expensive in the United States now. That's why...
So it's at the rich at the top and the poorest at the bottom.
And recent immigrants.
Particularly recent immigrants. Recent,
by the second generation, immigrant families don't do that anymore.
Right.
Because having a child is terribly painful for a family.
Right.
And so that the contradiction in family values, when you do everything to make it impossible to nurture a child and be there for your child, is a sick joke.
So I just want to nail this down.
Okay.
The rich continue to have children, but likely put them more and more into the private schools to escape the problem of the quality deterioration in so many of the public schools. The poor at the bottom, particularly the immigrants, having many children, fill up the public schools. The middle affords fewer and fewer children, tries, if it can, to get them to escape the poor quality of the... And nothing in the system handles this problem. And so what emerges, because that was the next question I was going to ask you, isn't there then something fundamentally a divide happening in American culture that the children illustrate?
Well, it's just like what you said about Uber. Those people who can afford it have different kinds of public schools. There are many smaller number because there aren't that many truly wealthy Americans. But, for example, I went to PS 59 on East 56th Street.
In New York City.
In New York City. And I was amazed. Not only was the quality of education phenomenal. I sat in on a conference about a child who was having trouble. The guidance counselor, Tricia, is always available if a kid has trouble. They can leave their classroom and go and talk to that person. They have, the principal was involved, his teacher was involved. Everyone was working to help this child.
And that's a public school.
Now, that is a public school. There's a minority of public schools that are usually not at all class integrated and have all the extras. Now, one of the reasons they have all the extras is their parents are influential and can get them. Another is people give up to $10,000 to the PTA. They have an active PTA of parents who have discretionary time. They're not exhausted from their dead-end jobs and having to work all the time. And so that there's a constant, very impressive list of activities always going on, flower sales, even, book sales.
Right, so that some public schools are able to replicate what private schools do.
Because they are, in effect, privatized, because the class base from which the neighborhood where the draws are is an upper-class neighborhood, and because people give individual contributions of enormous amounts of time to raise money, as well as money. A friend of mine whose husband is a bicycle messenger and she has a modest job went to the schools to look at schools in her Southeast Bronx neighborhood. She was horrified. Then she looked at a school in the Village. She and her husband thought, oh my God, it's a private school. And one of the reasons for that is that teachers have some discretion as to where they teach. And they don't want to teach in a school that has all sorts of extra problems, whose children have to be helped to even be ready to learn in the morning. Teachers in New York City who are in low-income schools often stop at the Pepperidge Farm day-old bread, come in with a gallon of milk and some bananas and old pastries, but pastries, and feed everyone in the class so that the kids who haven't eaten are not humiliated. They also have bags of extra clothing because kids come in dirty. You know, if your parents are both exhausted and sleeping, or they're working on different shifts and they're not there, and you have to get yourself ready, probably hygiene isn't a big item. So they have places to clean up and clean clothes that the teachers collect and bring in. What kind of a start to a school day is that, as compared to a child who comes in ready for school, fed, washed, and eager? There's, you know, you start children out with such huge class, mind you, disparities. People try to make inequality a race issue in the United States. However, it is a class issue at least as much as a race issue. African-American wealthy people have much more in common with white American wealthy people than they do with low-income African Americans. They go to the same schools, they do the same things. And I want to give you an example. The top schools in Washington, D.C., the three top schools, and I'm looking at Washington, it's our capital. It's where international people come to look at our country. The top schools are private schools. So, for example, the private school where Obama's children go, where Biden's grandchildren go, where Sean Donovan, who's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, where his children go, is called Sidwell Friends School. 40% of its enrollment is minorities. They're probably not poor. You know why? Because the tuition for lower and middle school is $37,750.
Per year?
Per year. Pre-kindergarten is $26,000. High school is about $40,000. Now, let's look at that. The median income in the United States is $28,000 a year. So if you sent your kid to preschool and you only made the median income, that's the middle. Right. It's not the lowest.
No, median is 50% have more,
and 50% have less. So you'd have $2,000 left after preschool for your entire other expenses for the year. In Washington itself, the median income, as many people are earning less as more, is $45,000. So the family would have $5,000 left after sending their high school child to Sidwell Friends. Now, what are we talking about? There is racial and ethnic integration, but there isn't class integration. And what does this mean? If you're in a public school, you can go to a better public school. If you're in a, quote, better, which means richer, neighborhood, where the housing costs more, whether you're buying or whether you're renting, the costs are much greater. So that's who's in the better schools. Now, there, you know, a good example is one of the places where children in the Southeast, teachers of the children in the Southeast Bronx are placed, is they have a program to try to induce people to be public school teachers. You can go from another field, and they will place you in a public school and pay for your master's degree so that you can be a teacher. You have to stay for 3 years. That's where they place the new teachers who haven't learned how to teach yet, in the places where the older teachers who have more choice won't go, places where there are multiple problems. So their education is at a much lower level on that score as well. And
well, wait a minute, before you go.
Yeah.
I want to draw a conclusion already. You, in the opening part of your presentation, you focus us on the medical, you might call it, the health, the difficulties,
the
literal life or death of a child coming into the world, depending on something that the child cannot even in the most extreme formulation be held to be blameworthy for. Child doesn't control where he or she comes into the world. But that if you come into the world poor, your life, your chance to live, the health conditions, the food conditions, the home conditions. No, first you did all the others. Now you're showing us that if you can get through all of that, you survive, and you can eat enough to grow, and you're finally sent to school, a whole nother set of discriminatory burdens overwhelm you because of the wealth your parents have or don't have, the neighborhood they can or cannot afford.
That's right.
By the time a young new person achieves young adulthood, the level of discriminations, the level of damage, the level of obstacles that come out of the class difference that you're born into, of course, then reproduces a country split in two.
And you live in either a safe neighborhood or a less safe neighborhood or an unsafe neighborhood, because the neighborhoods where public schools are quality schools have much higher rents and higher costs for housing. And 75% of American kids come home to an empty house. Their parents can't afford someone there for them and with them. That's when the most crimes against children and the most crimes committed by children happen. So you're
after
also
school.
Endangered. And if you're left alone, you're in a much more dangerous situation than if you're supervised by your nanny or someone else who's home or a parent who's home. So that on every level, your life is more precarious because of, and I can't emphasize this enough, because of class considerations. They always want to reduce it to a racial problem. It isn't merely a racial problem. It is a class problem. It depends on how much you can afford. And so that if you're poor, your parents are not going to be sending you to expensive after-school programs where you're escorted by whoever is hired to escort you. They're not going to pay for that. You go home to an empty house. And on your way home, you're much more liable to commit crimes and also
to be victimized.
So that your life is precarious on every level. And by segregating housing the way we have successfully done in the United States, you cut off people's chances even to know one another. I think one of the reasons that the wealthy can be so outrageously callous to children of low-income people is because they never see them. Our lives are so class segregated that you don't even ever know the children who are different, the parents who are working two jobs and not making it, and ravaged and upset and exhausted, and their children. And that has changed radically. In 1970, we were the most egalitarian nation in the world in terms of class, in the developed world, I should say. Now we are the least egalitarian nation in the whole developed world. Our lives are utterly segregated by class, often by race as well, but certainly by class.
Well, we're running out of time. I wanted to ask you, so we don't leave this, not that I'm upset that we leave it on note of real crisis, because we're
right.
in one.
We are.
But what would you say, fantasize for the audience for a minute, what kinds of things would have to be done? What's the scope of things to undo, to stop, to reverse the breaking of the country into a small number of people who don't enter life with this set of burdens you've just summarized?
Well, you'd need to have what every other country except United States, Somalia, Swaziland, mm-hmm. Papua New Guinea, and South Africa have, which is paid maternity leaves, excellent child care, and after-school care.
That's affordable to the mass of people.
Affordable or free. You know, in France, it's free starting at age 3. It's $1 an hour before that, and it can never be more than 15% of your income, plus after-school and summer programs. As far as education goes, you'd need to have what Max Wolf actually thought of in the early 1970s. He had a proposal, which is brilliant and class egalitarian, for educational parks where all the kids are bussed in to a really high quality school system.
From all the different neighborhoods
where you have small schools for the younger kids, middle schools, upper schools, where you pool all your resources so there's no duplication in buildings and equipment, and you have a totally well-equipped school program with very low teacher-pupil ratios so kids can get extra help. It's an obvious, smart idea.
And it would provide the resources to overcome the difficulties that will be there, but the democratic benefit of a society that loans it to one another, that doesn't have those kinds of obstacles that existed for the mass of the middle and lower income, the advantages would be more than worth the cost.
It gives children a chance educationally. And just like France, which has a pediatric nurse at the school. You can have pediatric medical personnel, nurses at the school, at the educational park, to help with children, as well as you could have subsidies, maternity and paternity leaves, which they have in most developed countries and which, well, in almost all countries in the world, which we don't have.
We've run out of time, sad. But let me thank you for being with us. And let me invite the audience, if you want more, as you have after Dr. Frod's earlier appearances, let me know, and we'll bring her right back. We've come to the end of our show. I want to remind you, please, to make use of our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. They contain vast amounts of material, just like this program, available to you when you wish, at no charge. Those are also the two websites through which you can subscribe to our newsletter and keep up with us that way. You can take portions and share them with your friends through social media. You can also contact us directly. You can click on Facebook and Twitter and follow us that way. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out. And please, remember that we are partners with you and you with us. Help us distribute this program. If you know of radio stations that might like to carry it, let us know. If you would like me to speak in your area to your institution, let us know. And in general, work with us to expand this kind of analysis throughout the country. Lord knows we need it. Thank you again for your time and your attention. I look forward to being with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.